So I thought that this would be an interesting topic, especially this time of year, in our Judeo-Christian calendar with Passover and Easter taking place. I believe Passover is April 10th through the 17th, and Easter is April 16th. And this comes up a lot. Not so much here, although occasionally, but in prison it's an ongoing topic. Can I practice Buddhism and have a belief in God? And conversely, do you believe in God? And what is God to you? And so I thought I would get into the historical perspective tonight, how the Buddha addressed this topic. And also because it's a big topic, and it's if I was to go around and ask each one of you to define God, we'd probably have 40 different definitions. So for the purpose of discussion, I'm going to call God the Creator God, the God who created the universe. And that is also the God that the Buddha spoke about. And we'll get into that in a moment. As I mentioned, this is going to be part one. I'm hoping you will all come back for part two, because you are part two. I really would like to have a discussion with all of you. I would just have a couple opening remarks from contemporary teachers and their thoughts on belief in God and Buddhist practice, and then how you all feel about it. And do you reconcile that with a belief in God with your practice or not? Rich, a couple of months ago, talked about Buddhism being a religion or not, and I think that is also part of what we're going to be talking about this evening. Also, as I'm talking, you have any comments or I have misstated something, please correct me, or please give me your interpretation. This is a lot of my understanding of what has been taught. I can misinterpret, and you might have a completely different interpretation than I do. Feel free to offer yours. So can we believe in God and also practice Buddhism? Does what the Buddha teaches cancel out the need for God? And as I mentioned, this goes on in prison constantly, and years ago I still have a number of Muslim inmates, but quite a large group, and they felt it was wrong that they were coming to Buddhist services, although they really enjoyed learning meditation and they enjoyed the discussion groups we had, but they were suffering from guilt. And so I made, and this is about 8-9 years ago, I made an appointment to visit Imam Aziz, who used to be head of the Islamic Center next to American River College. Really great person, by the way. It was a wonderful conversation. He also has TV newscasts and does teachings, and I've enjoyed him a lot. He's really just a wonderful, kind person. And I spoke to him about this and the Muslim guys and their concern, and he said, I have no problem with this at all. Tell them that's fine. And then he said, and what do you teach about God? I said, well, I don't address that concept. That he was not too pleased with. But I said, but they come to you for that. You know, I teach them meditation. He went, okay. All right. That's good. So in the Buddha's time, he was, I am convinced, as a result of his own culture, as you are, of your own cultures, of the variety of cultures we have. He lived in a time that was magical. So everything had a spirit. The mountains had a spirit, the trees had a spirit, rocks, people, animals, everybody had a spirit. The forest had a spirit. And this was an accepted part of life, that everything lived and everything had a spirit associated with it. And there were a variety of deities at the time. They were generally put into two classes, the devas and the brahmas. And the devas are kind of like angels, but not quite. They are very, very human-like. And there's also different deva realms to make it even more confusing. So some devas would be very, very advanced in their practice and would almost be up in the Brahma realm, while other ones really had a lot of work to do and would come to the Buddha for advice on how to navigate the path as they were trying to. At that time, too, to go back a bit, there were considered six realms of existence. And they started with the Brahma realm, which was the highest of the devas, for lack of a better word, and then the deva realm, and then the human realm, and that's us. And this was considered the most fortunate realm, because in this realm we could make decisions on how we would navigate our life and our meditation practice. And then below us is the animal realm, and even animals were considered capable of enlightenment. And below the animals are the kind of hell realms, two of them. And actually, what I just read recently, probably around 33 heavenly realms and 33 hell realms. So a lot of different places to go, with all these devas and brahmas and hell beings being in all of them. The devas or the brahmas were considered kind of super deities. They really advanced. It is said in the commentaries that they advanced so much in their meditation practice that they achieved the absorptions, the jhanic states, and were living mostly in heavenly bliss because of this. So, as I've read about these various realms, it kind of sounds like polytheism. You know, there's an awful lot of gods running around. And scholars say not, and there's a reason. And the reason is the devas and the brahmas were not perfect beings. They were still working off their own karma. Gods in the Buddha's time were mortals who did pretty well. But they were still mortal, and they still had their karma to deal with. And their karma bank would run out eventually. And if they didn't take care of themselves, they could end up back in the human realm. I don't believe, and maybe Rich knows, I don't think they can go below the human realm once you reach a deva or Brahma realm, but you could end up in the human realm if that's what your karma said. So it gets a little bit complicated. And then the other reason it is not polytheism is, and here's some characteristics of devas, Buddhist devas are not eternal. So as I said, they have a lifespan as well. Now, their lifespan might be thousands and thousands of years or even eons, but eventually their lifespan ends as well. And then they're reborn as some other sort of being, depending on their karma. And they do not create or shape the world. They come into existence due to their past karma, and they are subject to the natural laws just as we are. They're very much like human beings. They have individual personalities. They have individual problems. The Buddha advised them on occasion. In fact, one of the best-known suttas is the Mangala Sutta, which means blessings. And I'm just going to read you the very beginning of it, because the devas asked the Buddha for some advice. Thus I've heard on one occasion the Exalted One was dwelling at Anathapindika's monastery near Savatthi. Now when the night was far spent, a certain deity whose surpassing splendor illuminated the entire Jetta Grove. That was the other thing about devas. They're supposed to be very beautiful and shiny and bright. And standing thus, he addressed the Exalted One in verse. Many deities and men yearning after good have pondered on blessings. Pray tell me the greatest blessing. And then the Buddha recites the Mangala blessing and the highest blessings. So they're not morally perfect. They screw up. And when they screw up, they will go to the Buddha and ask for advice. And being a deva is not the goal of Buddhist practice. This means they're still suffering. In this lifetime, in so many traditions, it is said to be born as a human being is a 1 in a billion chance, and take advantage of it. Because this is your opportunity to get it right. The deva realm, as much as they enjoy and they have bliss, they can't do what we're doing. They cannot work out their karma. They can just live out their karma. Also, this is, I think, interesting. Metta practice, you know, which is boundless friendliness, was first practiced because the monks were going out into the forest, as the Buddha requested them to do, to meditate. He said, you should spend some time alone, work with your fear, and go out in the forest and meditate. So they did. Well, the devas out in the forest didn't want them around. And they said, this is our forest. We don't want you here. Out of here. And the monks didn't pay any attention because they couldn't hear them. So what the devas did, they started screeching and emitting foul odors and doing whatever they could to scare the monks, which they did. They accomplished their task. And the monks, well, you know, this place is haunted. These devas don't like us here. We're running back. They ran back to the Buddha and said, we don't want to meditate out in the forest. The devas are not happy that we're there. And so the Buddha taught the monks metta, boundless friendliness. And originally metta was taught as a protection against malevolent forces. So they went back out into the forest and recited the metta phrases. And the devas were so inspired by the metta phrases that they welcomed the monks to practice there. I think that's a lovely story. The closest Buddhism has to a creator god is Mahabrahma. Maha in Pali means greatest, supreme, and Brahma is the head of the gods. And Mahabrahma, let me back up a little bit. The Buddha taught that there is no beginning or end. The world and all of the world orders are eternal, and they always have been. So there's no need for a creator God. It is always going on. It cannot not go on. And I'll go into dependent origination in a little bit, but the first being, each time a world is formed, Big Bang Theory is probably as close as we could understand it. When a world is formed, Mahabrahma then comes into being due to causes and conditions. He is there, and he is under the illusion that he has created the universe. That's his problem. That's his karma, which is going to screw everything up for that for him. And the Buddha occasionally has to talk to Mahabrahma about, no, you did not. Nobody created the universe. It just always is and always will be. Because of this, there is that. And Mahabrahma doesn't get it and has got to be talked to on occasion. The other mythology about it is Mahabrahma, once the universe is born and he's the first being, he's lonely. These are very anthropomorphic kind of tendencies. And as soon as he realizes he's lonely, devas start appearing, causes and conditions. Because of his loneliness, they appear. And so the deva realm takes place. Eventually, all worlds collapse. Universe collapses. As scientists say, our universe will eventually collapse. And then it will reemerge again. The Buddha said this has happened countless, countless times. It has never stopped happening. That's a really hard concept to grasp. But that's the nature of Buddhist explanation of the universe. On occasion, the Buddha himself, being an enlightened being, would go up to the heavens, to the various realms, and offer teachings. And the most famous one was during the seventh rains retreat. Rains retreat is when the monks are resting for 3 months, meditating, deep contemplation and reflection, not having any visitors. And during that period, he went up to the heavens and taught his mother the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma is very dense psychological work of how our minds work. And it is said it took him 3 months to teach her the Abhidhamma and other enlightened beings that were up there. So, is this true? Well, I don't think so. But I think it's wonderful mythology, and I think it's wonderful to consider how this might work in our own lives. You know, even the six realms that I talked about, Brahma, Deva, human, hungry ghost, and the hell realms, we go through those, you know, pretty often. Just in our mental life, and I think a lot of contemporary teachers speak about the Buddhist cosmology this way, within our own minds is formations and the beginnings and suffering and happiness and joy and back down again over and over and over again. So for many contemporary teachers, this is the way this is taught. And I think if when you just sit in meditation or even in your daily life, you see this happening. The hungry ghost realm is this large, large being that has this giant body and a little pin mouth. And so he can never, ever be satisfied because he can't stuff enough in his mouth because his mouth is too small. This is greed. This is greed that can never be satisfied. And have you ever been there? I think we all have. It's just not enough. I need more. If I get more of this, I'll be happy. We've all been in the hell realm. You know, when a loved one dies or we get some horrible prognosis about a disease, we've been in the hell realm. And we've been in the deva realm and the Brahma realms as well. We've been very happy and elevated, and we've had great meditation sessions where, ah, I've arrived. No, you haven't. But those are the mental states that we go through, up and down. And as we start developing the ability to see this is what's happening, we don't take them all so seriously. We can just be with what's taking place rather than, I don't want it this way. So anyway, back to creation. There was a lay person who was a follower of the Buddha, and he went to the Buddha one day and demanded that that the Buddha tell him about creation, and essentially what will happen to him, what will happen when he dies, what happens during rebirth. And he went on and on, and he said, and if you don't tell me this, I'm not going to follow you anymore. And the Buddha said, well, you're not going to hear it because it's a waste of time. And this is when he gave the famous poisoned arrow simile. And I think all of you have heard the poisoned arrow simile. Who hasn't heard the poisoned arrow simile? Okay, a couple of you. So very quickly, it is just as if you had been shot by an arrow. And instead of going to the doctor and having the arrow pulled out, you first want to know, okay, who made this arrow anyway? And what's the wood that the shaft of this arrow is made of? And these feathers are unusual. What bird did they come from? And the Buddha said, by the time you've gone through all this questioning, you'll have died. And you'll never have accomplished anything. And you're going to be reborn and repeat the same thing all over again, kind of like Groundhog's Day. So, in the Savasava Sutta, the Buddha mentions 16 questions which can be seen as unwise reflection. I'm not going to go through them all, but essentially the same thing that this layperson was asking. Who am I? Did I exist before? Where am I going? What's going to happen to me? Will I exist in the future? What is the future anyway? How shall I be in the future? The Buddha called this a thicket of views. And this really goes back to right view. I was speaking to a friend about this today. Right view, I think, is best defined as looking at our wrong views, which are clinging to a view. Any time we start clinging to a view, we have cut off so much of the world. That's a view. That's what I'm sticking to. I'm not going anywhere else. And the Buddha said this is really unwise. This is why he wouldn't give an answer. As soon as he did, and this is actually the way I explain it in prison too, as soon as he would give an answer, would you all think the same thing about that answer? No, because of your own causes and conditions, your culture, your sex, your race, your this, your that, you're going to interpret it according to that filter. You're all going to have different answers to what the Buddha said. You're going to resolve it according to you. And then you'll create a religion because you've got the answer. And this is how religions get started. And what happens when we stick to our religious beliefs? I'm right, you're wrong. What happens? There's a tremendous amount of suffering that takes place when we stick to, I'm right, you're wrong, I have the answer, you don't. And this happened in the Buddha's time. He narrowed these views, this thicket of views, down to two different viewpoints which were predominant in India at the time. And one of them was eternalism and the other was nihilism. So in eternalism, which is pretty much what the Brahmin priest taught, was there is an eternal soul. And this eternal soul is unchanging. It's part of Brahma, maybe Mahabrahma, and it goes from one life to another. Not changing. Eternal. And the other way of thinking was the nihilist, who said, no, there is no soul. There is nothing other than what you have right here. This body, this mind. You die, they die, that's the end of it. And that was it. So the Buddha defined these two points of view this way. The propositions that the world is eternal, that the world is infinite, that the Tathagata, which is how he defines himself, exists after death, and that the self is independent of the body, reflect the view of existence. the propositions that the world is not eternal, that the world is finite, that the Tathagata does not exist after death, and the self is identical with the body, reflect the view of non-existence. So those were the two schools of thought. And he said, these two schools of thought have very dire consequences. And the first one is the ethical considerations. And you think about the ethical considerations, as the Buddha defined it. If you have an eternal soul that is unchanging, no matter what, why would you bother being ethical? Anybody have an answer to that? Why would you bother being ethical if this eternal soul is going to keep going on? It is affected by nothing. So that was the first problem that he said. And he said the second problem is we do not see how things really are. We're not seeing the world as it really is. Impermanent. So he has stated everything is dependent on something else. This is dependent origination. You cannot have a unique soul, according to the Buddha, that goes on and on and on without causes and conditions shaping it. If there even is such a thing. And the same with the nihilists. Neither are compatible with dependent origination, which emphasizes causes and conditions. This is also what he said about the rising and falling of the universe and why it is continual, it has never stopped, it never will stop. It will expand and contract, and it has done it forever, and it will continue doing it forever. So he also said morality, some people, and I think today it's also stated, if we don't have God, we don't have morality. And those of you who have been coming here for a while know that's not true. We emphasize the five training precepts over and over again. I also just saw a documentary, maybe some of you have seen it, and it's Richard Dawkins, atheist person, and it's called Sex, Death, and the Meaning of Life. And the second episode, it's a three-part series, is on sin. And he talks to a lot of religious figures who say, if you don't have God, you will not have morality. So he studies this and actually finds that people who don't have a God are more moral. And the reason is they're not restricted on this person is okay and that person isn't. I encourage you to see it. It's very, very interesting. The Buddha also appears to believe that the God idea of having a God is a response to frustration and fear. And he said, gripped by fear, men go to the sacred mountains, sacred groves, sacred trees, and sacred shrines. So frustration, and I think we've all seen this happen, and when things aren't going our way, I prayed. I tried my best and went to church and did all this, and still my loved one died, or I got sick, or, a fire, all these things happen. How many people have had their faith betrayed because of these kind of things? And then he said also fear of death. This is, I think, probably the big one, why many of us believe in God, the fear of the unknown. He said that rational understanding replaces fear, and I can speak from my own experience working with those who, 3 or 4 years I taught Maranasati, mindfulness of death. And I think it made a big difference for a lot of people who had a fear of death, and to actually study death. study the process, study the rationality behind it, fear tends to dissipate. This is the way it is for every living thing. I'm no different. And it's okay. This is a process just like everything is a process. So according to the Buddha, the world exists dependent on causes and conditions, and it ceases to exist in this fathom-long body. Now, another hard concept. The world ceases to exist when we uproot greed, hatred, and delusion. That's a hard concept. And I think that's as close to God as Buddhism gets. In this body, as we said, the human realm, to be born as a human is a privilege, an incredible privilege. And in this body, the world and suffering can cease to exist by uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion. Now, I would believe that many of you have had periods of this, even if it was quick, really, really quick. But you've had a period of time when you noticed everything was perfect as it was. I know you have. The problem is, and this is part of my teaching and my learning, is paying attention. We're so busy wanting things different or especially getting on to the next thing. You know, this perfect moment where nothing needs to change except the thought, oh, but I should be doing this. I need to get on to that. And then there it's gone. So I think we have these real sublime moments, but we pass them by. And maybe that's a little piece of God. I don't know. The Buddha also said, for a creator God, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence for a creator God? He didn't see it. And so he said, unless somebody can prove this to me, I'm not going there. Dependent origination is what keeps the world going. You know, the Dalai Lama was asked a number of years ago during, he holds these sessions with scientists because he very much wants to align himself with scientists. You know, he's to be admired tremendously. And a scientist was asking him about rebirth and can you prove it? And he said, as soon as you disprove it, I'll quit teaching it. And I think that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, I believe it. It brings me comfort. I think it's true. But if you tell me, and he went into more detail, that it's not true and you scientifically prove that, then it will no longer be taught. That's good. So in Buddhism, Nibbana is the goal, and Nibbana is not a heavenly realm. And it's like Rich was speaking about, I think last week or the week before, it's a verb. Nibbana is a verb. It never was heaven and the Deva realm and the Brahma realm and you wear a pair of wings and go floating around playing harps or something, which never sounded appealing anyway. But it is the act of ridding yourself of greed, hatred, and delusion. Like I said, you've had the experience. The trick is to be with the experience. This is why retreats are so important. It kind of forces you to be with that experience and go, ah, that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. In contemporary society, the way I see it, and this is my thoughts, well, let me raise it. I've got a very dear friend who used to live here in Sacramento. She moved many years ago, first to the Seychelles Islands, and now she lives in Italy. She is an avowed atheist. I mean, rampant. I mean, she'll put any evangelical Christian to shame with, you know, just the diatribes and how stupid religious people are, and on and on and on. And if she wasn't a dear friend, I would not have her as a Facebook friend. just because it's endless. And then I've got another friend who is a born-again Christian, and not the one you're thinking of, but a different one. And she is exactly the same way, coming from the other angle. You know, you're going to hell, Diane. You don't believe in God. You don't stand a chance. And I love you, and I want you to accept God and Jesus Christ as your Savior. Please do this for me. So I've got one friend and the other friend. And this, to me, is exactly what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about nihilism and eternalism. It's just the contemporary version of it. And I think the Buddha's point in right view of not holding to a fixed view is the answer. I personally think if there is a God, if there is this superior being, we are in no condition to understand it. Unless somebody with a purified mind who has ceased all clinging, like someone like the Dalai Lama, and, well, the Dalai Lama actually says he's not ceased all clinging, so not even the Dalai Lama, but somebody who says this is what they've experienced, that's what I'd be open to, my own personal point of view. I'm going to end with two things. First, have any of you heard of Brad Warner? He's a young Zen teacher. Yeah, he's spoken at SBMG, and he's, I think, quite good. And he's a young man, and he wrote a book. And I think this really synthesizes God and Buddhism. And the name of the book is There Is No God, and He Is Always With You. I think that's perfect. It's a koan. There is no answer, as far as my feelings on it. The final thing is another little Zen story. So there was a Zen master who is considered all-knowing, enlightened, calm, peaceful. Everybody wanted to be his student and hear him teach, and so he had a new student who came in to see him, and the new student said, all I want to know is about rebirth. Is there life after death? And the Zen master looked at him and said, I don't know. And the student went, what? You're the enlightened Zen master. I'm coming here to get these answers. He said, I'm not a dead enlightened Zen master. So that's the end. If you have any, and as I mentioned, I hope you come back in 2 weeks, because I really do want to have a discussion with all of you, either in small groups or a large group, about your thoughts on this topic. I don't think anybody has the answer. I think maybe some of us get closer due to our mind state and our practice and whatever that means, but I don't think any of us have the answer. So any comments, questions, concerns about anything? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I was wondering, I thought Hinduism was around at the time. Was that there too? Or
As far as I know, Hinduism as it is today was not. It was called Brahmanism. And so there were castes, five caste systems, and the Brahma priests led the ceremonies, which allowed the soul to go on to its next incarnation and to keep the world going and that kind of thing. But as far as I know, it was not Hinduism as it is practiced today. Rich, is that your understanding?
Oh, okay.
Jeff, is that your understanding?
Yeah, it was a lot like Greek, what was in Greek mythology. You know, there were gods for all sorts of things, but there wasn't sort of a systematic, coherent philosophy like you see with Hinduism.
Yeah, it was a magical world at that time. Like I said, it almost, as I was reading about it, almost reminded me a little bit of Native Americanism, you know, and you know, with spirits in everything, and appeasing spirits in everything.
The one tenet of Brahmanism that survives in Hinduism today that's rejected by the Buddha is the notion of the Atman, of the eternal.
Right, the soul.
Soul.
Yeah.
Our universal soul, that we are sort of fragments.
Right.
He says that's not right.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where he said, because it has ethical consequences, if this is unchanging, then why even do anything to help your fellow person? This is going to happen anyway. You'll go back to Brahma. So, yeah. Yeah, Todd.
This is part question and part observation. But I seem to recall hearing about the Dalai Lama being asked if he thought it was necessary for people to give up their religions.
Mm-hmm.
And he said no,
right.
He didn't, because if it helps them be a better person and if it helps them be happy, then he's all for it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So that's that seemed very compassionate and very pragmatic, but I know from my own experience growing up that what was taught to me, which I think out of sincerity of, you know, and wanting to do the right thing, the implications have been damaging, of believing that there's something out there that's going to help me, and if I just sit here and pray hard enough, then I'll get to wherever I need to go. Meanwhile, I'm in a train wreck heading toward a cliff, and it's like, that's not going to help. And just some very fundamental misconceptions of how the world works that just caused unnecessary suffering, I think, in relationships and whatever. So I see a tension in a little bit about what you're saying, that which I can see in my own experience, that if you grab onto one side or the other, it, either way, it leads to judgmentalism and suffering, and unnecessary suffering. That I confirm that in my own experience, and yet there's this aspect of love and compassion for other people and not needing to proselytize or get them to change.
You know, the Buddha said, following the Noble Eightfold Path and practicing the Brahma Viharas is what we need to do in this lifetime. This will lead to the erasing of greed, hatred, and delusion. And for me, that means being okay with things when they're not okay. And normally, as you said, I believe in God, I pray, why is this happening to me? You know, that happens all the time to people. In this practice, it's okay. That's the way life is. You cannot have a great time without the opposite happening at some point. It's just the way life is. And no longer just coming unglued because it happened. Thanks, Todd. Yeah.
Richard Dreyfuss, the fellow you were watching, what was his name?
Richard Dawkins.
Dawkins, yeah. Mm-hmm. Where did you
Netflix.
What's it called?
It is called, and it's a three-part series. Sex, Death, and the Meaning of Life by Richard Dawkins. And it's very, very good. While he's an atheist, he's also very kind, which a lot of fundamental atheists, for lack of a better word, are not. He's very good friends with religious figures, and he has discussions with them. And that's what he does also in this series.
Why are you saying that most atheists are grumpy?
I guess I shouldn't. I'm really forming a judgment there. I'm thinking mostly of my friend, the one that I really should not be friends with on Facebook anymore. Because it's not that I disagree with her or disagree with the other person. It's just so much noise, you know. And just reinforcing, I talked about confirmation bias a couple of weeks ago, and it just seems like that's all they're doing is, you know, same thing over and over again, just proving how right I am, and it just gets, don't want to hear it anymore.
You realize, of course, you could unfriend them. No, I mean, you don't have to completely cut off. They could.
You stay friends, but
you just don't get the daily missives anymore.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. All right. Anything else?
I don't know if I can put this into words or not, but, you know, you kind of had the juxtapositions of, I guess, faith and not faith, or, you know, and feeling doctrinaire on the same side. And it seems like the best option is to follow the precepts and avoid what was it, hate, delusion, and greed.
Greed,
you know,
greed.
Avoid those things. But in order to function, you need a framework or something. So it seems like you should have a working hypothesis that you keep working on. Did Buddha say anything about that? Like, you know, you have to have, you know, in our existence, we're finite, and we have to have a sense of what is in order to even move, you know, or do you have any sense of direction or functioning? Did he address that kind of issue?
I've got so many things I could answer. Rich? Rich, you take that on. That's exactly it. That's exactly what I was going to say. The Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are the framework. And if you're looking, okay, if I do that, this will be the outcome. No. That is not the case. But if I do this and I don't cling to what I think should happen, then you're on the right track as far as I believe. Rich, you got... Yes.
You have to read the lyrics of Bob Dylan.
That's a good ending. Okay, so it is 9:00. Yes, in 2 weeks we're going to have further discussion on this. I'm going to bring in what some contemporary teachers have to say, because there's some very intriguing things that have been said, and there's also, whether you know it or not, some very large disagreements in Buddhist world on God and pure awareness and, you know, various things. So we'll be bringing in those, and also your own experience with or without God and your own Buddhist practice. Okay? So in 2 weeks, be there or be square. So final metta. So may we all in this room no happiness, no freedom. May we be freed from greed, hatred, and delusion in this lifetime. And may the benefit of our practice today be given freely to all sentient beings, that all beings are free and happy, and may all beings be well throughout time.